Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten, mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto, das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und Ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Vishala Sripathma, and on this edition, fueling tensions between the European Union and China as Beijing plans to slap tariffs on EU petrol cars. Is there a way back for these two trading giants, or have bridges been burnt? Plus, President Putin arrives in Hanoi to a rock star welcome, but what's in it for him?
The Russians really hope that they can invest more in Vietnam, especially in the energy and defence areas.
And we hear from Nairobi, where tens of thousands of young people have taken to the streets.
Literally huge, huge, massive number of people on the streets today.
More from Nairobi later in the programme. And remember, you can email us on world.business@bbc.co.uk. Well, let's start with trade, and tit for tat tariffs appear to be the name of the game between Europe and China at the moment. Their current spat is over cars for now. State media in China have said that car companies are calling for import taxes of up to 25% on EU petrol cars. And it comes a week after the bloc announced tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, claiming that Chinese car makers have an unfair advantage because they're given handouts from the government, enabling them to sell cars at a cut-down price relative to their European rivals. So what do the car companies in Europe make of all this? Well, on Wednesday, we spoke to the Citroën head, Thierry Coscas.
We generally praise open markets because this is a way to really face the competition. At the end of the day, even if we do not compete in Europe because there are some tariffs, we will have to face the Chinese in other parts of the world, in India, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in other markets. So we need to be able to compete against the Chinese with the same weapons as they have, which means the production costs.
Thierry Coscas there. So is this a sign of things to come? Is this the straw that broke the camel's back? Well, earlier I spoke to Dmitry Grusobinski, who is a former Australian diplomat who worked on trade negotiations. And he's also the author of a book called Why Politicians Lie About Trade.
I think what the EU is trying to do is balance the fact that they feel like Chinese products that are coming into their markets are being unfairly subsidized by China, with not creating the same level of antagonism as you see in the US-Chinese relationship. So they're not as hostile as they could be, and the EU is trying to manage the level of hostility.
And when you say they're trying to manage the level of hostility, these tariffs that they slapped on electric vehicles last week, on Chinese electric vehicles, that seems pretty severe.
It's certainly a bold step. The EU would say, listen, we've followed all of the rules. We've conducted an investigation to work out how much are Chinese subsidies distorting the price of these vehicles, and put in place a tariff that kind of brings Chinese vehicle prices into line with where they should be without these subsidies. And they say, listen, compare us to the United States, which has four or five times higher tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles now. We are following the rules and being proportionate, whereas they are not.
And in terms of China's point of view, it's quite a delicate balancing act for them. Clearly, their economy is hugely dependent on the likes of Europe and America buying their goods. And, you know, we've seen their economy transform over the last, say, 20 years. Chinese economy has flourished. Are they perhaps slightly worried about the pushback here because they've got quite a lot to lose?
Absolutely. I think China is trying to balance retaining access to the markets that it needs with wanting to steer its economy the way it has been doing through a combination of government intervention and national champions, where it is picking and supporting the companies and sectors it wants to see grow. So it's trying to balance that with managing the retaliation from trading partners like the European Union.
And so where do we go from here? Is there a way back, do you think? Because things have started to perhaps sour. How do they get back on track?
So it's far from guaranteed that they will. One option is that effectively this becomes the new status quo and we simply don't escalate from here. So you have these tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, you have tariffs going the other way on European electric vehicles, on some European agricultural products, and both sides kind of say, okay, well, that's the new status quo. Businesses adjust, trade flows adjust, and we kind of roll on. The other scenario is that things continue to escalate with more and more tariffs slapped back and forth, and that begins to significantly impact bilateral trade and therefore people's livelihoods. The only kind of the optimistic path forward is, for example, as has happened a number of times with the European Union and the United States, their trading relationship, where they kind of threaten to or they put tariffs on each other. And that brings both sides to the negotiating table to find some sort of compromise to get those down again.
Now, the European Union, they've accused the Chinese government in sort of helping car makers in China. And that's why they're able to sell cars at a very competitive price compared to their European counterparts. They think that's unfair. And that's the reasoning behind the tariffs, to sort of almost rebalance that trading relationship. But it's much more than that, isn't it, with tariffs? There's a lot more symbolism there.
Everything in trade is always 50% plus political. When you see a move like this, it is always as much about talking to your own constituency as it is talking to other countries. It's as much, as you say, about symbolically showing that the Commission is ready to use the tools in its toolkit to stand up for European manufacturing as it is about the sort of euros and euro cents involved.
And just finally, what does this mean for consumers and what they pay for goods like cars in this example?
A tariff is ultimately a tax on consumers. It's kind of like a patriotism tax. You are going to buy something foreign and we are going to tax you for that because you didn't buy something local. So ultimately, it does push upward prices as you either pay the tariff or you buy something that you wouldn't have bought if that tariff hadn't been there.
That was Dmitry Gusa-Binsky speaking to me a bit earlier on. Well, time to say hello to our markets guest now. And today I'm joined by Lucy Coutts, who's Investment Director at JM Finn. Hello, Lucy. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello.
So we were just talking about those tariffs. Have we seen any impact on the markets in the last week or so? Because we've been talking a bit about these proposed electric vehicle tariffs as well over the last sort of 10 days.
No, there hasn't been much response in the sort of the likes with the auto manufacturers. I mean, I think that the EU, you know, is generally turning more protective in policy in response. But I think both parties should have reason for wanting to strike a deal because it really doesn't make sense for the consumer, and we're all just sort of getting over an inflationary environment, and tariffs will make inflation come to investors' minds once again.
It'll be interesting to see what effect it has on European car makers, for example, though, who are sort of quite big compositions on the European indices, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So the likes of Porsche or BMW, etc. I mean, they're hugely sensitive to this. And yeah, the margins that they make are much lower than those in China, where their sort of industrial production is much more efficient. And also the goods are coming across are much cheaper. So, you know, it's a highly competitive industry. And, you know, auto manufacturers, the margins themselves on cars are very, very small by the time they get to the sort of the showroom floor.
And Lisa, just briefly, we've just heard from the Bank of England about interest rates. They're holding rates at 5.25%, despite that news earlier on in the week about inflation holding at 2%, or sorry, slowing to 2% even, which is their target. It was expected they would hold rates, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, the Bank of England can't be perceived to be biased in any way, particularly when we've got an election going on. But I think the words certainly are that we can expect our first rate cut perhaps in August. You know, policymakers, what we don't want is that the policymakers cut rates too late and the economies both here in the US and, sorry, here in the UK and also in the US, they react too late and then we see the countries go into recession. So okay. I think it's a fine balance.
Okay, Lucy, we'll have you throughout the programme. Lucy Coutts there, Investment Director.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sport Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To JM Finn. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Well, that was a military band in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, there, at a welcoming ceremony for the Russian President, Vladimir Putin, who's there on a state visit, hot off the heels of his trip to North Korea. Well, Mr. Putin's visit to Vietnam could pave the way for new economic ties, at least around energy. For Vietnam, it's a bit of a diplomatic tightrope, so to speak. It's a rising economy in the East that is dependent on Europeans and Americans buying its goods. This visit has already attracted disapproving looks, though, from the West, with the US criticising Hanoi with normalising what they call is Russia's blatant violations of international law. So it's a bit of a tricky wicket for them. I spoke earlier to Vietnamese journalist Na Pham, who's in Taipei at the moment. She explained why this visit is important to her country.
Traditionally, Russia was a very important economic partner for Vietnam. During the 1980s, especially, it gave lots of economic support to the Vietnamese government then under the embargo of the United States. But in the last two decades or so, the bilateral economic ties between the two countries have diminished almost. So Russia is only investing in a couple of projects in oil and gas production and energy in Vietnam. But with the visit by President Putin, I think the Russian really hope that they can renew the bilateral ties and invest more in Vietnam, especially in the energy and defence areas.
And do you think that's on the cards? Do you think a trade deal or some sort of economic partnership will be announced over the coming days?
I think the visit is mostly symbolic to prove to the world that Russia still has some friends. You know, Moscow and Putin are not really welcomed anywhere. I mean, Putin is under sanctions by the US and also he's wanted by the International Criminal Court. So North Korea and Vietnam are obviously, you know, two very few friends that he has left. So that is the symbolism of the visit. Obviously, Putin is not really looking for, you know, a big economic agreements or anything. There were some meetings between Rosatom, the Russian state atomic energy corporation, and the Vietnamese, but it didn't end with any agreement. Rosatom wants to help build the first nuclear power plant in Vietnam, but I think the Vietnamese prime minister told him that it's not possible at the moment. So, yeah, I don't think there will be any big economic agreements to be announced.
Is there a concern about risking relationships and ties with the West? Because Vietnam is a leading exporter of textiles and counts on the likes of the US, for example, as an important partner.
Yes, there has been concern, and quite rightly so, because you know, Vietnam has a policy of be friends with every country and not trying to balance between world powers. But it is in a very tight spot because, you know, Vietnam bought a lot of weapons, and you know, on the military scheme, Vietnam is dependent on Russia. It cannot be without Russia if it wants to defend its own sovereignty. So that's why Vietnam cannot detach and decouple from Russia overnight. And I think the West understands that.
Journalist Na Pham speaking to me earlier from Taipei. Protesters there on the streets of Nairobi, tens of thousands of them angry about new government proposals to tax a whole raft of goods and services. Well, Kenya, like many countries across East Africa, are reeling from a cost of living crisis that has seen prices rise sharply, taking its toll on families and businesses across the wealth spectrum. Now the country is no stranger to demonstrations, but what's unique about this protest, we hear, is that the scores of young people that are taking part, as the BBC's Mercy Juma explained from Nairobi.
So the demonstrations that are happening not only in Nairobi but other parts of the country as well are just to step up pressure on Parliament to vote against a very controversial bill. And this is the Financial Bill 2024, which is, as we speak, being debated in Parliament. And it seeks to raise about $2.6 billion through new taxes for the government. So it's the government just adding new taxes on people who are already burdened, actually overburdened by the cost of living, by the already existing taxes, in order for it to raise more money. So that's what the bill is about. But Kenyans are saying they don't want that bill and they don't want it to be amended, which is what has been done. When protests started on Tuesday, government came up and said they had done away with some proposals, including like proposal to add a 16% VAT on braid, to add a VAT on financial services and foreign exchange transactions. So those were scrapped off. But Kenyans who are on the streets are saying they want the whole bill scrapped off, not just parts of it being amended.
Do we know how much more Kenyans will end up paying, for example, on VAT if they went out for a meal or purchased goods that they ordinarily would do?
We don't know the exact details or rather the exact calculations because it's still being debated. But we are talking about like the price of things like sanitary towels, price of things like diapers going up by a couple of dollars or a couple of shillings, and that just doesn't sit well with Kenyans. So it is small items that would eventually cost a little bit more and eventually really adding a lot to the monthly or weekly budget of an individual person, from food, from fuel, from how people run their business, even from financial transactions, and all this really add up to a big amount at the end of the month or at the end of the week.
Now, these demonstrations on the streets of Nairobi look like they've been organised on rather a large scale. Tell us a little bit about how they've been over the last couple of days.
Indeed. And, you know, I have covered protests before, but I don't think I have covered anything like this. We are seeing young people, people in their 20s, 19-year-olds, 25, 26-year-olds really coming out in large numbers. And, you know, these protests started from a rallying call on social media, people using hashtag Occupy Parliament, and urging Kenyans to just come up and keep vigilance parliament and members of parliament debate and vote on the bill. Normally, we've seen protests that are usually financed or propelled by politicians, mostly from the opposition side. But this is not led by any politician. It's not led by people who are, you know, elderly people in their 50s or 60s, like we have seen when our politicians come up and rally people to come out. It's the young people, and they say they are tired. They say, you know, they have watched their parents struggle. They have watched, you know, past regimes struggle, and they just don't want. They say they are protecting their future. So it's really amazing to see. And other than that, it's a mostly peaceful protest. And peaceful, I'm talking about there are no people throwing stones. Cars are parked on the streets and nobody is damaging these cars. Nobody is throwing stones. But they are just relentless. They keep pushing and pushing, you know, the police and really trying to get to parliament, which they haven't been able to get through yet. But I must admit that they have really kept the police and the security forces on their toes.
How many people do you think are out on the streets?
Oh, my goodness. I would say like tens of thousands, probably. I've just come back from the Nairobi Central Business District, and literally almost all the streets in the Central Business District are occupied. There are thousands, tens of thousands of people out there. There are other towns in Western Kenya, Kisumu, even in the President William Ruto's backyard, the town of Eldoret, people came out in extremely huge numbers, still protesting this bill. And also we have seen even now the elderly people coming out. Like, I met a mother, she is 56, and she was on the streets with her two girls, and she says her generation failed Kenya because they failed to come out and protest when they should have done, and she's there to support the people. So literally huge, huge, massive number of people on the streets today.
That was Mercy Juma in Nairobi, and you can read more about those protests on the BBC News website. Well, let's turn our attention now to the global shipping industry, where leaders have issued an unusual joint statement calling for urgent action to be taken in the Red Sea to stop attacks on merchant shipping by Yemen's Houthi rebels. Now, it follows the sinking of a second ship called the MV Tudor. This is Christian Domerique, who is the captain of the ship, describing the attack.
Yung sumunod po na pagsabog is around 1300.
The explosions happened around lunchtime. It was an attack by drone from the side of the ship. We weren't able to investigate immediately, and initially we didn't know who our enemy was and whether it was from the sea or from the air. We hid inside the ship, and all we could do was pray.
So that was Christian Domerique, the captain of the MV Tudor, the ship that was attacked there. Now, Iran-aligned Houthi militants first launched drone and missile strikes back in November on this very important trade route in what they say is solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Now, in more than 70 attacks, they've also seized one vessel and its crew and killed at least three seafarers. Well, with me now is Guy Platten, Jet Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. Thank you very much for joining us, Guy.
Yeah, good afternoon.
What impact are these attacks having?
I mean, firstly, trade is now moving towards the south coast of Africa, but it actually is, what's happening to the attacks on these ships is absolutely unacceptable. We've had seafarers killed. We still remember we've got 25 seafarers and the MV Galaxy Leader held hostage in Yemen. So, you know, as an industry, we've you know, enough is enough, and we condemn all these attacks with the greatest possible force.
What are the shipping companies doing to reduce these attacks?
Well, about 50% of the trade has now shifted to go around the south coast of Africa, adding 10 to 14 days to their voyages and obviously increasing costs. Shipping companies who still use the take a risk assessment sort of based approach to whether the ships go through. But the Houthis originally declared that only vessels associated with Israel and ships calling at Israeli ports would be considered legitimate military targets. But this has subsequently been extended as time has gone on. So the attacks are intelligence-led and not indiscriminate. And at the end of the day, innocent seafarers are suffering as a result of all of this.
So in this situation where they're being attacked, how are they defending themselves?
So we issue, I can't go into all the details, we issue quite detailed advice and guidance to shipping companies and for their crews as well to take what action they can. But these attacks are well considered. They're done by drones. They're done by missiles and all sorts of projectiles as well. So there's only a limit to what you can do to protect yourself. And what we're calling on is every country which has got any influence is to try and get these attacks stopped, because ultimately this is affecting world trade. But more importantly, it's affecting the lives of seafarers and their families.
So are they effectively running for cover? Are they rerouting? What do they do in these circumstances?
So they're rerouting. There is military operations in the area which can come to their assistance. But the best thing to happen is for these attacks to stop. They're just not acceptable on any level. I mean, we've heard of a seafarer being killed, the ship sunk. You know, what that family must be thinking now as well is just you can't really imagine. They can't even give the loved one a decent send-off or burial or anything like that. So it's just, I think as an industry, we have had enough, and we need governments to sit up and take notice that shipping is almost the innocent victim here, and everyone depends on trade and shipping for their everyday lives. If this was aircraft or anything like that, we're hearing a lot more in the media, but you know, it's something we do need to bring to attention to governments, and they need to consider this and use all influence to get them stopped.
So the International Maritime Task Force exists. Are they making a difference?
They do make a difference, but unfortunately for every 100 ships which get free of an attack, one is now being attacked. So it is making a difference, and we're really grateful for what's happening. But nonetheless, we need to find a solution to this to actually de-escalate and to stop the attacks in the first place, because we really cannot see an end to this.
And just a quick question on sort of the impact on the industry. Clearly, this is taking its toll on costs as well.
Absolutely. Costs are rising as a result. There's now port congestion because, you try and get the most economic and efficient route from A to B. But now with the additional time it's taken, that's using up all the spare capacity. That's causing an increasing rates. So there is a cost to the consumer at the end of the day for all of this.
OK. Guy Platten, Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. Thank you very much for joining us. So Lucy Coutts is still with us, our markets guest today, investment director at JMFIN. Hi, Lucy. We've been talking lots about sort of the Bank of England a bit earlier on about the impact of their decision to keep rates as they are. And we'll touch on that in just a moment. But something I do want to talk about is Golden Goose. Now, if you're of a certain age, the term Golden Goose will remind you of Roald Dahl and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But this is in reference to a very fancy Italian company.
It is. So their shoes sell for around €500 a pair. I think one of its wearers is Taylor Swift. So it's an Italian company, as you rightly say. It was due to float on the public markets tomorrow. It's currently owned by a private equity house called Permira. And the float has been pulled due to volatility in European political markets, which is sort of pretty much driven by National Rally, which is France's right, far-right party, gaining 31% of votes in European parliamentary elections and causing Macron to call the snap election. So the Parisian market, they're down sort of 6.5% since that news, and a lot of shares have actually been under pressure, like Moncler and LVMH. And Permira is quite badly burned because it floated Dr. Martens in 2021, and those shares are down 80%. So I think they're being very cautious.
Does this happen frequently, or is this quite rare?
This is quite rare, but I think it's quite difficult in European markets at the moment with what is going on and where interest rates are, and really Permira doesn't want another failed IPO. I don't think it has. I don't think it's completely a done sort of thing, in the sense of it's never going to appear in public markets. I just don't think the conditions are right. And it's very, very important that the timing is right, so investors get on board.
So sorry to cut in there, but we're just running out of time. Thank you very much for joining us. Lucy Coutts, Investment Director at the stockbrokers JMFIN. That's it for this edition of World Business Report. Thanks for listening.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sport Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.